Off the Ball Breakfast.
I find it funny your analogy for this Champions League is that it's a sinking ship.
Well, am I talking about the world or am I talking about football? Either way, Atalanta are getting out.
Live every weekday morning from 7:30 on your smart speaker. Just ask Alexa to play OTB Sports Radio.
Introducing a new Off the Ball Football Podcast Original. Richie McCormick's Sliding Doors. These are the stories of those big money deals that just didn't quite happen.
Figo. Ronaldo. Made space for himself. Ronaldo's shot. Pick that out. What a hat-trick.
Episode 1 of this podcast series focuses on Ronaldo and a move to Glasgow Rangers. Subscribe now in your OTB Football podcast feed to not miss an episode of this six-part series coming to you live each and every Monday.
To the final, to be honest.
Yeah?
Yeah. I believe in my county and I suppose they're good at football, they just have to believe in themselves.
I love playing 12, I love playing 10, I love being on the pitch, to be honest.
Are you confident?
Absolutely not.
Oh, no!
Thank you for all the supporters, thank you for the team, thank you France. Merci la France, merci les baguettes, merci les croissants. Je vous aime, I love you.
Hello, hello. Welcome along to Word on the Street, the pod where every week we take a sporting topic and we take it to the public, usually. This week, we're kind of taking a topic that's already been in the public eye for the past week or so, and we're delving into it a little bit. So first and foremost, I'm Susanna. I'm here with Eve and Rachel as always. How are we guys?
Oh, good. How are you?
Do you know what? I'm okay.
Are you?
I'm not. I have a really sore back. But apart from that, I feel like if my back wasn't injured, I'd be completely fine.
Mm.
So that's my reasoning.
I don't even know how to sum up my week.
You've had like one of the most weeks of all time. You know what I mean?
As
so many things
week,
have happened.
For anyone who listened to last week's pod, in an update, house still leaking, moved out, toe still black. So I reckon
succinct.
That sums it up.
Yeah, I like that. It's the Thursday of a bank holiday weekend.
Oh, thank the Lord.
St. Bridget, my favourite. Saint.
Is it your favourite saint?
Of course.
Lovely.
It's my confirmation name, St. Bridget.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Had to be done. I'm hoping for bigger and better things in February. My 2026 didn't really kick off in January.
No one's really does, I think. Especially when it was like a 5-week January. We've had 5 weekends in January, am I correct in saying that? It's been like a really ridiculously long month.
We celebrate like the Chinese New Year.
Yeah.
You're the horse.
Let's reset.
Yeah.
With that, this is episode 36 and it's called Mind the Gap, which I thought was very clever. And it kind of was kicked off by Katie Taylor's comments during the week. Rachel, were you at the event where she kind of said all this?
Yeah, so it was the launch of the Ladies Football National Leagues, sponsored by Lidl, in Croke Park last Tuesday. And Katie Taylor came and spoke and she was everything I dreamed of and more. She was incredible.
Was it your first time ever seeing her kind of in person?
Yeah, totally. And like, you know, she'd speak after, like, I was going to say matches, after fights and stuff, but like never that detailed about like her personal life and everything like that. And I know she seems to be doing like a bit of a kind of a PR tour at the moment. Like she had an event down in Killarney, but she was so powerful. Like everyone in the room was just glued to her every word. It started off a bit slow, but then she started telling the story about how she was part of the first ever sanctioned fight in Ireland. And essentially she got boxing put into the Olympics and just before she had like an exhibition fight, they came up to her and were like, tomorrow's fight, the quality of it will decide whether we put Olympics boxing in the Olympics or not. I mean, like, the pressure on her shoulders was incredible, but she spoke so well. But then afterwards she was kind of saying that it was all very positive, and she was saying that if I was a man right now, which we'll hear from in a minute, she'd be a multi-millionaire.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone's seen the kind of social media clips and graphics going around, but we do have a little bit of audio from Katie chatting to Ireland AM on the day, so we'll play that first.
I mean, it really was history in the making. Of course, it was broadcast on Netflix at the time. Yeah. A huge world audience tuned in.
Yeah, I think even for the second event, the second five, I think maybe 74 million viewers viewed it for that fight alone. I think it was the biggest viewership of a female sport event in the history of the US. So it was just so special and amazing to have that platform. Amazing to be able to showcase with talents in front of the whole world.
Now, 2026 hopefully is a promising year for you. Obviously, you haven't been in the ring since last year. Yeah. Do you plan to make a comeback?
I do, actually. You know, I was thinking I'd love to end my career here in Ireland, and I'd love to have my final fight here. This is, will probably be my last year in the ring, I'd say, and I'd love to end my career here in Ireland. And the Crow Park is looking very nice today, isn't it?
It is.
So please make it happen, please. I want to end my career here.
Before we get into the topic of the day, please let Katie Taylor fight in Crow Park. I will work for free off the ball if you're listening. I will go to it and work for free. How amazing would that be to see?
I just think the fact that she had to be like, please, on a national broadcast, yeah. I'm like, who is saying no? God almighty, just give it to her.
She is like the most successful sports person to ever understand. Come out of this country, and she has to beg, and there's no even, on off the ball, like last week on the news round, we were talking about this, you know, and Mick and Owen were chatting about, you know, this is, the GAA needs to be allowing this, Crow Park needs to be facilitating this. I know money is an issue, but it has to be done. And we clipped that piece for social media, and all of the comments, for once, I've never seen this on social media, all of the comments were in agreement.
I know.
Everyone was just saying, I would just die to see Katie Taylor fight in person in her home country.
And that's the point she made at that event. She was like, so many of my big fights have been abroad. Irish people can't afford to travel to them. Yeah. Like, it's not fair that you haven't gotten to see. Like, she's cited as everyone's hero, pretty much. You know, in those, we talked about it before. It was like the Sunday Times or the Irish Times, like who's your sporting hero? And Katie Taylor tops the charts all the time. Just to get to see her in person in Crow Park. Make it happen, please.
That's
I don't know
I'm
who needs
like,
to hear this.
Girl, no need to beg. Country is behind you. But she also said on that day, as you kind of alluded to, she said, quote, if I was a male, I'd be a multi-millionaire. And in her last fight, which she spoke about there in the audio, she beat Amanda Serrano at Madison Square Garden. That was last July, extending her record to 25 wins to one loss, which is just insane. And that was watched by an estimated 6 million people on Netflix alone. And she said she still only got a fraction of the pay that the men get. So I think it's just kind of sparked a whole realization of how prevalent the gender wage gap in sport still is, especially in boxing. But as we've been digging in, when I was researching for this, I was actually overwhelmed by the amount of information that's out there and by the amount of sports where this is still such a big issue. I mean, I think it's one of the biggest ones, or one of the most prominent examples, is the WNBA in America, where I think it was Caitlin Clark, I'd need to find the exact figures, but she was picked as a first draft coming out of college, and that resulted in a $336,000 salary over the next 4 years. This, at the same time, there was a first draft picked in the NBA, Butcher is last name, Wemby.
Yeah.
Thank you. Wemby received a $55 million contract. And in the years that's like followed since she joined the WNBA, she's gained more views than most male basketball players. And she's done insane things for the league as a whole. It's got so much viewership. I think it signed a new broadcast deal, a historic one last year. And yet she's still being paid pittance compared to male basketball stars.
And that was one of the kind of, stuck out to me the most, because the WNBA players, I mean, they are not taking this quietly. You know, they're speaking up about the fact that, you know, they want they wore protest t-shirts ahead of a recent All-Star game saying, pay us what you owe us. And we were talking about
last
this
year, yeah, I think.
Yeah, before the show, and we were talking about this incredible, so WNBA players were keen to highlight that they were only asking for an equal percentage of league revenue rather than equal money. So it's not like these female athletes in are asking for something that is perhaps materially impossible based on kind of what revenue is being brought in and blah, blah, blah. Like, it's, you are asking for equal treatment.
Yeah, that's the main argument, isn't it, that you'd hear? And which you're going to be having a conversation later, Eva, and I'm just really interested to hear it, because as soon as you say gender pay gap in sports, the automatic answer is, yeah, but the women's teams don't bring in as much money as the men's teams, so they don't maybe deserve, is probably a tough word to use here, but why would they get the same pay when they don't bring in the same revenue? And like, if you look at it in a kind of a binary way, yes, okay, fair enough, but what the WNBA are doing are saying they're not looking for the same pay as their male counterparts. They're just looking for the same amount of the profits.
Yeah.
So if the males get 50%,
so the males get 50, and they were getting, I think, around 25 of their own profits of what they put on a show to perform, drawing fans into the games and to watch on TV, providing the WNBA with profit. And they're not getting the same amount.
Yeah, like, no, I don't think anybody can argue with that.
No.
You had an interesting point then when we discussed the whole, but they don't bring in the same amount of money as their male counterparts, Susanna.
In terms of the WNBA specifically, or?
Where you're saying that, like, it's a real, what came first, the chicken or the egg? You know, what came first, the investment or the equal pay?
Yeah, I was reading an article where they were basically, I think this is a quote, they were saying that we must end the cyclical notion that women's sports must first attract a greater audience to secure greater sponsorship, investment and prime scheduling. Without increased funding and favourable scheduling, attracting interest in audiences is considerably harder. So it's just this awkward cycle of they're saying, okay, women aren't bringing in enough money, so we're not going to pay them as much and we're not going to provide them with the same facilities as the men's. But then because they don't have the same facilities and because they have to have a second job, or, you know, the majority of female athletes still have a second, like, primary job, which is crazy. And then they can't put on the same show, or they can't dedicate as much to their sport. And then it's not going to bring in as much eyeballs and as much money. So it's just this...
It's a vicious cycle.
Cycle. And I know you're going to be chatting to someone later, Eve, but the tennis is such a key example of somewhere that they still haven't got it all right, but they've gotten certain things right.
When you look at the tennis, it's remarkable how far ahead they are of almost every other sport in this regard.
Shout out Billie Jean King.
Yes, love
her.
What
a woman.
Because we're highlighting the WNBA and how they're kind of compromising in a very intelligent way by saying, we just want the equal share of the profits. Whereas back in 1973, Billie Jean King was like, we played the same game, I am getting the same money. And she fought for, on behalf of every female tennis player, in that US Open, and it became the first tournament in the world to offer equal prize money. And like, she is over 50 years later still having to fight that fight, because women's tennis, although far more equal to male tennis than perhaps other sports, still is on a lower pay grade when you look at kind of overall at the WTA. And I'll be chatting later on to Caitlin Thompson, who is the co-founder of tennis magazine Racket, and she's written a lot about this, and I really want to pick her brain.
I'm so interested to listen to that.
Yeah, about kind of what more can tennis do to make it perhaps more equal, but also what can other sports learn from tennis?
Well, that's the thing, because thanks to Billie Jean King, as you said, they went out on a kind of a limb in that I can imagine in 1973, women's tennis wasn't getting the same eyeballs or support as men's tennis. But they decided, okay, we're doing the equal prize money at Grand Slams. And now off the back of that, women's tennis is huge.
I love women's tennis.
It shows, this isn't just opinion. Like, I think the last four US Open finals have had more viewership for the women's final than the men's. Now, that's maybe partially because Coco Gauff was maybe in a few of them. I don't know.
Yeah, she was. But I mean, if you look at in the last 20 years, the Williams sisters would always have been in a lot of them.
True.
As well. And for them to retire and for, you know, American tennis still to be so propped up by the female side of it, it's fantastic. You know?
And it just shows that maybe this model can work. That, okay, you take a gamble in the beginning, but by giving the women the support that they need, you're going to create a product that in the end becomes much more equal to the men's, rather than trying to do it in terms of, okay, we have to earn all the money first and then we can invest in the women's game. Because there's a lot, when you read, there's all about how, you know, even women's soccer is so new. Like the, what's the...
The WSL.
WSL, yeah. Mm-hmm. It only,
became professional a couple of years ago, I think.
Yeah, and like fair play to like the women's national team in America, you know, they took that kind of that first stand saying that we deserve the same pay as our male counterparts because they were doing, they were far outperforming the males. Mm. We saw that in 2021 in Ireland as well, you know, that our women's national team now get the same international appearance fee as the men. It's such a tricky topic because I don't have the solutions. I've been sitting on the solutions here the whole time. It's going to take so much investment, so much time, and just like a little bit of a kind of a shift in perspective from a lot of people, I think, because tennis is a great example because people don't compare the men's and the women's game as much, I think. When you talk about football and rugby, I think a lot of people go, well, compare that to the quality of a men's match. Mm. I feel like people are less likely to do that.
I feel like the quality
in sports like tennis.
Yeah. It's so similar because for so long they've been more equal. It's the exact same self-repeating cycle you were saying. You know, young girls are told you can't be a rugby player and then there's no facilities for young girls. Mm. And then maybe if they get into it as a teenager, they haven't had the years of training that the lads have had. So of course the lads are going to be further ahead. It's all repeating, repeating, repeating.
Yeah. Yeah, but they keep saying, you know, the men's game took, you know, became professional 150 years ago. We have to be patient, give the women's games time, which I do understand to a certain degree. And, you know, it can't happen overnight that we're suddenly creating huge profit. But I do think maybe if you're looking at the tennis example, is there a different way to approach it rather than just waiting for the game to build itself up? Mm. But yeah. It's also interesting, and I know you're going to talk to Caitlin about this, in terms of whose responsibility is it? Is it on the national governing body, like, you know, FAI, RFU, who are already doing a lot? Like, in terms of the FAI, you said they've, you know, the base salary, is that what's equal between the men and the women's?
It was just for, like, international appearances.
Okay, yeah. It's something anyway. Yeah. Or is it, you know, in terms of the tennis, it's the prize money isn't coming from the national federations, it's coming from the sporting organisation that organises the event.
It's all mixed up in politics as well. It's a fascinating topic to kind of dive into.
And yeah, we probably should have given ourselves like 3 weeks to discuss this every day for 20 minutes.
We were like, we're going to do a 5 minute intro 15 minutes later.
But this is why I'm glad that we're going to have an expert to talk to.
So coming up next, I wish I could be here in it with you because it's going to be so interesting. But Rachel and I have to run. But you're going to be chatting to Caitlin Thompson, founder of Racket Magazine, which kickstarted in 2016 and launched their first issue in time for the 2017 US Open. So good luck with that. Can't wait to hear it.
So we are here for another episode of Word on the Street, and we are joined by the co-founder of Racket Magazine, Caitlin Thompson. First of all, how are you today?
I'm well, thank you. I'm just watching some Australian Open.
I was going to touch on that for a second before we dive into the... We're talking about kind of gender pay gaps in sport this week, but just looking at the Australian Open, it's not been a great second week, maybe in terms of the quality.
Agreed completely. I actually think, as has been the case for many of the major tournaments in the last couple of years, the women's draw is far more compelling than the men's. There's just a lot more parity on the women's side of the sport, and so the results can be quite unpredictable. That said, we've had a pretty predictable setup here for the finals with Aryna Sabalenka from Belarus facing off against Elena Rybakina, which is, I think, probably the third or fourth time these two have met in a Grand Slam final. So just not terribly surprising that the two of them are meeting again. But at least the matches up until then have been pretty entertaining. The men's side, it's really Carlos and Jannik, Sinner and Alcaraz. Not in that order, of course, we're talking about. And they're the ones who are just so far ahead of the pack that it kind of doesn't matter what happens up until the final, because those two, unless something dramatic occurs or one of them gets injured or there's a massive upset, it's sort of a foregone conclusion. So yeah, the tennis in Australia has not been as dynamic or as exciting as we've seen in other slams. I have a lot of opinions about why. I think it's too early in the season. But, you know, it's hard to complain, especially from New York City, where we have many, many feet of snow here. Watching tennis on our televisions is not the worst thing I can think of.
If we're looking at the quality of women's tennis right now versus perhaps the quality of men's tennis, which is the top two are always going to be very good, and maybe the rest of them aren't reaching that kind of standard. When we look at gender pay gaps in sports, we kind of were brought onto this topic looking at Katie Taylor, an Irish boxer, kind of the Irish boxer, the Irish sports person. She was talking this week and saying if she was a man, she'd be a multi-millionaire by now because of the results she's had. And when looking at wider issues of the wage gap in sports, tennis always stands out as a kind of example where it is far more equal than a lot of other sports. How, I guess for people who maybe don't have a lot of context to this, how significant was Billie Jean King's advocacy and her fight for equal pay?
Yeah, I mean, it's really a landmark game changer, both in the sense that obviously her advocacy while she was an active athlete to create what became the WTA Tour, the Women's Tennis Association, in 1973, can't be underestimated in terms of the sea change it caused. You know, originally she and the other women that became the original nine, as they're known, the women who played on the tour, who forewent higher paid appearances elsewhere and joined this tour for $1, led by the inimitable Gladys Heldman, who was the woman who kind of organized it all. There's just like legends on legends on legends for this group of people, led, of course, by Billie Jean, who created this tour. And, you know, they tried for years to work with the men to have a joint tour, to create a ticket that would accommodate both, because women's tennis, and probably part of the reason that we see close to pay parity in this sport, is just it has a massive, massive history, whereas a lot of these sports don't. And so they really had a head start, and they had decades and decades of proving the product, creating a fanship. And Billie was really ahead of her time in sort of coming to the men and saying, hey, this sport is the only one that has men and women on the court at the same time in the form of mixed doubles. You've seen other sports attempt to sort of replicate some of the success of that as we look towards, you know, Olympic events like joint gender skiing and stuff like that. But really, women's and men's tennis is the only sport that allows for folks to play on the same field at the same time. And we've had a ton of success showing that when men and women play at the same tournament, the ratings, the interest, the fanship is just massive. That still holds true. And so after decades of trying to work with the men, who of course shut the door in their face, they created their own tour. And what was notable about that is that, yes, of course, it established this way for women to get paid to be professional athletes ahead of any other sport, but also what it did was train a generation of fans to watch women's sports and to value it, and also of other athletes. And so Billie, one thing that I think doesn't get enough credit is after establishing this tour, and of course passing some landmark legislation here in the United States called Title IX, which we can get into, but also had a lot to do with gender equality in schools, especially when it came to sports, which still isn't enacted today, was also she went and advised other sports. She advised other athletes. Our footballers here, the women are famously much, much better than our men. And she's gone and sat with them and helped them negotiate contracts and helped them create leagues from scratch. She's done the same with the WNBA. She's done the same with the women's hockey. So a lot of the lessons that, you know, she learned the hard way went into nurturing and helping other women in other sports. And so they're just farther behind. And in some cases, they have a little bit higher of a hill to climb. But I think for a lot of reasons, you know, it's been encouraging to see the rise of all these other women's sports, because the truth is they just haven't had the runway and the decades of, you know, advanced learnings and training of fanships and sponsors to support them the way that tennis has. And that is mainly why it's still so far ahead.
Definitely, because I feel like so much of this is all tied into business and politics and, of course, at the kind of root of it all, money. And in the same kind of vein of, if you can't see it, you can't be it, you're encouraging young girls to get into sports. If, you know, sponsors or businesses aren't seeing women's sports, they won't be encouraged to sponsor it. Whereas perhaps in the women's game, since it's been on for so long at such an equal playing field, you're seeing these, you know, very significant pay parity in terms of prize money, but not everywhere. I mean, outside of the Grand Slams, I think we've chose Cincinnati as an example. Mm-hmm. You're still having unequal prize money between the WTA and the ATP. Is this just purely because they're different organizations? Why is one still higher than the other?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of two things at play here. Cincinnati is not the only tournament that is mandatory on the tour. There's required participation at a number of the top tournaments, obviously the four Grand Slams, but also what they call these Masters 1000s tournaments. Cincinnati, as you mentioned, is one. There's another one in Rome, dual gender, Indian Wells, which is coming up soon in the US, is one, and Miami another. Anyway, I could go on. But these tours stops are mandatory for players, but not in every case. Actually, in most cases, they are not equal pay. It's up to the tournament's discretion. And most of what is sort of frustrating as a tennis person, you know, racket covers other racket sports as well, but tennis is really our main focus. And what has been frustrating about it is just seeing how much innovation and early adoption of a lot of ideas and structures and promotional, you know, tactics that put tennis really out in front of everyone have now sort of stalled out because of how ossified our governing structure is. And you've seen a lot of these newer leagues really gain ground, which is not the worst thing in the world. You know, I think for all of us sports fans, seeing a varied and interesting and diverse body of sports to choose from and watch at all times, where the level of competition is really high, is like sort of the best possible outcome, right? It's an embarrassment of riches if we get that. And one of the things that's sort of been frustrating as a tennis person is just the governing body is not being aligned. We have seven, and they aren't on the same page. A lot of these, basically it works as a loosely federated network of fiefdoms. And so it's sort of up to the, you know, sort of how visionary, how forward thinking, and how smart are these different stops along the tour at promoting, sort of weaponizing and best productizing what is, you know, arguably the best sport, certainly if you're a woman, to play. And it really varies, right? I mean, you go to Indian Wells where we there's a billionaire owner who's not concerned at all with any tabs. He's building the best possible facilities. It's an incredible experience for fans. He's ensuring equal prize money. The players love to play there. And as a result, it's in most circles that I run in more popular and certainly more of a good user experience than most of the Grand Slams, right? And so that's a great example of, oh, investment actually equals a superior product that then can be a roadmap for others. So yeah, there's still a little bit of that. The other thing you didn't mention, which I think is sort of the unspoken part of this, is just the endorsements, right? So in a lot of cases, regardless of whether there's parity on the pay side, the endorsements don't tend to fall equally. Tennis is probably the best, usually when there's rankings of the top 10 highest earners in sports, certainly on the women's side, the majority of those are tennis. When we talk about endorsements, that's included. And I think for us, seeing the explosion in how much under optimization, I mean, not to use a cheesy business term, but really, truly, like, there's so much opportunity in the world of women's sports in particular, seeing the valuations of these teams just skyrocket. If I were an investor, if I were a brand, if I were somebody who was looking to really create a portfolio that was really valuable, buying up some of these teams, leagues, supporting some of these athletes wouldn't be a decision I would make out of the goodness of my heart, although maybe, but it would just be good business sense. Buying into a men's sport outfit, a soccer team, a football team here in the US is basically impossible, but buying into some of these emerging sports where we've seen in New York City, our local basketball WNBA team, the Liberty, grow sort of inconceivably in valuation in the last 3 or 4 years. And it just sort of is like, ah, this is an untapped market. And this is something that people would be smart to get on board, not because they can feel good about it, but because it's just going to make business sense. So I think those are two main factors, I think, in why, you know, there's still a little bit of a discrepancy.
Yeah, that sort of ties into something I was going to ask a bit later on, but I'm going to ask now, in terms of how would you, I think, go about reducing the gap further in terms of endorsements, in terms of kind of in ensuring that the parity that's there on perhaps one level is matched on different ones, or at least closed up? And what can other sports kind of learn from what tennis has done?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest one, and I mentioned this earlier, is just that tennis is fractured. We're quite balkanized in the decision-making process. I think if you have a streamlined product and you have a streamlined way to do business and you can get league-wide sponsors, it's the easiest. You know, I'm talking to you sitting in a country where football is probably the most or one of the most popular sports, and it too is really fractured between ownership groups and leagues and all this. But there seems to be a little bit more of an optimization than there is in tennis. So certainly the first thing would be reducing the number of decision makers at the table and just sort of saying, okay, we're going to all sell one product. It's going to be aligned and we can sort of get behind this notion of the story, the brand proposition, et cetera. I mean, if you look at F1, one of the things that I think they've done really well is really streamlined the product. Obviously, each of those individual athletes from different teams are superstars as they deserve to be, but the league itself is benefiting a lot from the growth that is it has invested because they've done really smart media deals, sponsorship deals, and they do them cohesively as a unit. So that's a really big one. And then the other thing I think is sort of interesting, we've been doing a lot of work in the paddle space. I'm not sure how big it is for you guys in Ireland, but it's growing very, very quickly here.
It's getting very big here as well.
In the UK, it's certainly exploded. And it's really interesting to see a sport sort of sui generis create an optimized product very similar to tennis, where the men's division, the women's division, and the mixed division all have very interesting value propositions that are relatively aligned. It's like almost like they don't have all the baggage that a lot of these sports do, where sort of men were afraid of competing for eyeballs alongside the women, and there's a game of catch-up to be done. And so it's really encouraging, I think, to see a lot of these emerging sports start from the ground up, where there's just the expectation that even though the product is different, it might be just as compelling for a different reason. And, you know, I think I'm going to go on a little bit of a tangent here, but I do feel like it's important to address with tennis the argument about women getting paid equally when they're only playing best of three sets, as opposed to men playing the best of five sets. That's something that usually comes up when you talk about pay. And it tends to fly in the face of a lot of the facts, which is that a lot of the men's matches, especially at Grand Slams, which are the only tournaments where the five sets are in effect, early rounds tend to be walkovers. A lot of the matches themselves are relatively low quality. People tend to remember the last set, not so much the middle sets. But it can't be denied that it is a different set of rules that are being applied to men and women. And I think there's a growing movement of people, both in the sort of internet age where sitting down, much like a cricket match to, you know, an endless game, if you're sitting down to a 5-hour match, you know, we look back to the Andy Murray, Novak Djokovic matches of the Australian Open. And it's just like, you know, have you got all day, actually? Because it's going to be a lot of backhand cross-court exchanges for hours with very little sort of exciting moments. I think there's a growing movement to not only, after the women have offered to play five sets and been rejected, to say, okay, well, everyone at these tournaments is going to play three sets in the first week, and then everyone in the tournament in the second week, when the matches get a little sparser but more theoretically high quality, everyone can play five sets and above. And I think a rule like that would be such a no-brainer. The women are ready to play it. They're happy to. It's just a scheduling issue for a lot of the courts and the tradition and a little bit of the hidebound ossification of the governing bodies, especially at these slams, who don't want to go embrace tradition, have been preventing it. So I think a solution like that could be like, oh, well, great. This is actually an equal product. Again, the women's matches tend to be more compelling anyway right now because it's a little bit more equal and even, at least across the field up until the final. So I think, you know, what I really want to see and what I've learned in the decade since I've been doing racket is just you'll meet a lot of people who will say like, well, things can't be done that way. They've never been done. You know, it's the same in every industry, right? And then you think, well, you know, we lived in an age of kings where divine blood right was theoretically the governance structure that we all lived under. Nothing matters. We can do whatever we want. We saw during COVID, the French Open was in October, you know, cats and dogs living together. Like, let's just keep moving forward. Otherwise, we're going to get stuck in the past. And so I do think that, especially with this new generation of viewers, certainly the new generation of players, and hopefully the newest generations of leaders in these sports start to look and say, ah, even if it's not from the good of our hearts, we're going to create a better and better product because it will be more popular and make us more money. And I think at the end of the day, we can probably at least always count on that to be a rationale.
I think that's completely right. And it was actually, that was going to be my next question as well. That's sort of best of three versus best of five. And I think Billie Jean King has previously mentioned that sort of first week three sets, second week five sets solution, which to me as well would solve so many other problems like the scheduling at the French Open where completely women... Right. People aren't playing the evening sessions. And as well, as a fan of tennis, I'm desperate to see a a Swiatek-Sabalenka five-set final.
I think it would be phenomenal. I mean, don't forget, Billie Jean King won the Battle of the Sexes in a best-of-five match against Bobby Riggs. Like, women are game to do this. Serena and Venus have played a few. We'd love to see it, especially when it matters towards the end of the tournament. You know, the truth is, tennis can be ups and downs. You can have a set where you go on a little bit of a mental vacation. It's true of everyone who's ever played the sport. It's probably true of anyone who's played any sport. And so this idea that we get more of a product when it really counts is really great. But if you're sitting courtside watching, you know, a French Open match between two journeymen, or even worse, a star and a bit of a tomato can, and the star has two sets to love on the guy, you just think, now somebody really should throw in the towel here, because this is going to be an obligatory extra 25 minutes that's going to further embarrass this man. The chances of him coming back are nil. And, you know, what are we really doing here? I think we can probably all move on. And so, you know, I never want to root against the spirit of competition, but I think just thinking a little bit about how, especially with the new fanship that tennis has created since the recreational re-emergence of COVID, you know, why not continue to innovate and improve our product? I don't see why there's any downside in doing that. You know, traditions are great as long as they make sense and serve the game as it is. When everyone was playing on grass tennis courts with wooden rackets serving and volleying, where the average point length was, you know, 1.3 seconds, sure, best of five is a nice way to ensure you get past an hour. Now, you know, people can elongate a rally for 40, 50 balls. So let's just be smart about how to evolve the conversation, I think. So anyway, I could speak about this, obviously, for a very long time, because it's usually a critique. But that's why I got it in front of you on it, because I do want to address it, because otherwise it just feels like, you know, you're comparing apples to oranges.
Exactly. And I think I'll only ask one more question. I wasn't initially going to ask that, but you brought up COVID and paddle. And it definitely, in Ireland at least, it was during COVID that paddle seemed to explode. And you have courts across the country that are booked out, and you actually cannot go and play paddle unless you book weeks in advance. Why do you think that specifically paddle is capturing people's attention in perhaps the way that traditional tennis isn't, or maybe isn't as much anymore?
It's a good question. I think, you know, here in the States, we're still seeing an uptick in tennis such that I don't know that paddle is cannibalizing it. I think the big threat to us here is something that is barely worth either of our times, but pickleball was for a time considered a little bit more of a cannibalistic upstart, largely because they don't have purpose-built facilities, so they tend to squat on other existing places, not only tennis courts, but, you know, school playgrounds. I'm gesticulating towards the West Village over here in New York, where famously a group of pickleballers tried to take over a children's elementary school playground and fisticuffs ensued and the police had to get involved. So aside from those sort of like bad actors, paddle is a really interesting and fun sport because of its relative ease of adoption, but it's difficult enough that it keeps people interested and there's an actual game to improve upon. I think COVID is really an interesting inflection point for a lot of participatory sports, because it was at that moment that I think a lot of people realized, like, oh, we don't have to be in front of our screens all day. We actually can get as much work done, but also have some sort of work-life balance that involves us getting outside. And paddle is much easier to learn than tennis. But the ceiling of it, the way that it can be played at a very high level, and if you've ever seen a professional paddle match, we actually came out with a paddle magazine last year, sort of as a one-off, just because we felt like the stories were interesting. And the tour from the professional side went to some really interesting places. Started in Mexico, got imported into southern Spain, into Andalusia. From there, went to the Scandinavia, Dubai, up into the UK and other places in Northern Europe. And so just this idea that it was this sort of really global, interconnected sport was also really interesting. And if you watch it, it's quite hard, but you don't have to be that level to enjoy it. And it kind of does the best of the thing that tennis does, which is that it creates a social opportunity where people can be playing alongside each other in a way that's, you know, sort of a good workout and also quite fun. So yeah, it's been really fun to see. I actually yesterday got the chance to play both paddle and tennis, which is sort of my diet these days. I'm playing both. But it is really interesting to see when a sport comes onto the scene almost from in a sui generis way, like I said, and creates opportunities for people to get involved in it, invest in it, create new facilities. And I think from a business standpoint, that is where a lot of the capital has flown. It's very hard to invest in sports. There's not that many teams. In tennis, it's nearly impossible. In paddle, you can build a facility, you can invest in a team, you can create a brand. And because it's relatively unexplored territory, you have a lot of chance of upside, which is what we're seeing right now.
Perfect. Listen, I think that's all we have time for today, but this was an incredibly interesting discussion. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Nice to meet you.
Introducing a new Off the Ball football podcast original. Richie McCormick's Sliding Doors. These are the stories of those big money deals that just didn't quite happen.
Ronaldo.
Figo. Ronaldo. Made space for himself. Ronaldo's shot. Pick that out. What a hat trick.
Episode 1 of this podcast series focuses on Ronaldo and a move to Glasgow Rangers. Subscribe now in your OTB football podcast feed to not miss an episode of this 6-part series coming to you live each and every Monday.